Pacific Mornings
on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, have you ever had an itch that you just couldn't scratch? Or perhaps a burning question that you just needed answered? Have you ever wondered, how can governments and corporations benefit from disasters and war zones? Or how might this happen? Well, next, we talk to someone who has wondered that and a whole lot more. And you would have read his writing in the New York Times or The Guardian, where he was a weekly columnist, or The Washington Post or The Huffington Post, if it's been in print. Chances are my next guest wrote in it, Anthony Lowenstein. He's an author, a filmmaker and independent journalist, and he spent 10 years researching in Afghanistan, in Haiti and in the Pacific, the autonomous region of Bougainville, and also in Papua New Guinea. And his most current project is his book, Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of a Catastrophe, and the film Disaster Capitalism. And he joins me now. Anthony, welcome back to Pacific Mornings.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Anthony, amongst other things, you're described as an atheist Jewish Australian and a German political activist, and your 2010 ABC Radio National feature documentary, A Different Kind of Jew, made you a finalist in the UN Media Peace Awards. If you're a different kind of Jew, in a nutshell, what kind of Jew are you?
I guess you've been reading my Wikipedia entry. So basically, what does that mean? So I was born Jewish. I'm in my early 40s. I was born Jewish in Melbourne, in Australia, and I was brought up in a liberal Jewish home. So for those who don't know what that means, it means that it wasn't, you know, rammed down my throat. I went to synagogue regularly with my parents. I had a bar mitzvah, a sort of Jewish ceremony that boys and girls have when they're 12 or 13. But I always had a discomfort with what I saw as the blind support that the Jewish community often gave to Israel. Now, I didn't have the language or understanding maybe to really explain or fully get that when I was 12 or 13 or 14, but by the time I was in my early 20s, I'd done a lot of research. I found a knee-jerk blind tribalism towards a country, Israel, by not all Jews, but many Jews. And what made me very uncomfortable about that was Israel, as many people will be aware, has been occupying Palestinian land for decades and continues to do so in violation of international law. There are millions and millions of Palestinians living under a brutal military occupation. And it seemed to me, particularly with the history that Jews have, not least in the 20th century with the Holocaust, the killing of 6 million Jews in Nazi Europe, that we should be particularly sensitive to when oppression is taking place. So that's been a long journey. I've written a number of books about this question. I've spent time in the Middle East. I've lived in Jerusalem. I've visited the West Bank and Gaza and all these other places. And I guess now I would call myself an atheist Jew. So what does that mean? That means that I see myself as an atheist. I don't believe in God or a higher being, but I feel culturally Jewish. And I think this is a term that if you'd said it to Jews 50, 60 years ago would have been pretty strange, although some Jews obviously were atheist and also culturally Jewish. But now in the West, it's not uncommon at all. In fact, I've met a lot of people who call themselves atheist Muslims, atheist Christians. So it sounds like a contradiction. On the one hand, to not believe in God, but also, for example, say that I'm Christian or Muslim or Jewish. But in my case, the culture around Judaism in a range of different ways is something that I'm proud to keep. And the tradition of dissent, which was a central part of Judaism, but I would say particularly since Israel became a country in the late 1940s, that dissent often has been far less prominent, which I think is sad.
Indeed. So you also co-authored another book, After Zionism, with Ahmed Moore, and it's a collection of the world's leading writers and thinkers on the Israel-Palestine conflict. So what's it like editing prolific writers on such contentious issues?
Challenging. Look, for some of those writers, of course, they've been edited a lot before. They're pretty good writers. So on one level, they don't need a lot of editing. We generally had tried to get a good balance between Palestinians, Jews, men and women from across the world. They were mostly from either the Middle East, the US or UK. And I guess Ahmed's Palestinian, born in Gaza. I'm a Jew born in Australia. So we like the idea of a Jew and a Palestinian working together, not in a sort of airy-fairy way, you know, saying let's all group hug and make the world a better place. I mean, the world politically is pretty pretty broken at the moment in many ways. But we thought that it was important to say that Jews and Palestinians can speak to each other with respect. There can be disagreements, but ultimately also there can be an agreement about what that vision should look like. And with Ahmed and I, although obviously we don't agree on every single issue, in general we support the idea of a one democratic state where Jews, Palestinians, Christians, atheists, whoever can live in that territory, which sounds like a fairly uncontroversial thing to suggest. The majority of Western countries, although Australia or the US calls itself, I guess, a Christian country, there are a lot of people within those countries, of course, who are not. They're atheist, Muslim, whatever they may be, Hindu. And there's no reason to me why a enlightened progressive state could exist in that part of the world that is open and tolerant of all peoples. It feels very, very far away these days, sadly.
So, Anthony, you're a writer and you have contributed to so many different publications. What's the difference between editing a book, editing a film as well, and editing just a small article? Is there a difference?
There is. I mean, the film, for example, took Disaster Capitalism took 6 years of a lot of hard work and going to challenging places. So, as you said at the beginning, we went to Afghanistan, Haiti, and Papua New Guinea, Bougainville twice, but also I spent time in other parts of Papua New Guinea. So organising those trips logistically, financially, et cetera, takes time. Raising the money. You work in a team in filmmaking, so I had a director, I had a producer, so you're managing also personalities and differences of opinion. And I guess for me over the years, I've been, a professional journalist now for about 15 years, I have a range of interests in lots of different subjects. And I think for me, when I started writing about Israel-Palestine, in the early 2000s, and I got a lot of flack for that, particularly from elements of the Jewish community and the conservative press in a very post 9/11 environment, saying that, almost suggesting and sometimes directly saying that it was treasonous to argue that what Israel is doing is totally unacceptable, that I as a Jew am deeply ashamed of this. And what I was saying in writing was pretty conventional at the time. My views have probably hardened in the last 15 years. But I suppose I made the decision back then that because I was getting so much hate mail and death threats, it might sound strange. I didn't feel, just to be clear, that in Australia I was likely to lose my life. Thankfully, touch wood, so far journalists in Australia are mostly not physically assaulted. That has happened now and then. There are many parts of the world, of course, where journalists are killed simply for doing their job. In fact, in many parts of the Pacific, as your listeners will be aware, where being a journalist can be a very dangerous enterprise.
Yes.
And I respect those people a great deal for taking those risks. So I wanted to do lots of different work and different issues, but an article would generally take a short amount of time to write and research. It depends on the issue, of course. And a film or book takes years. And you have to have, I guess, a commitment and also a self-motivation, because when you're at home, and I work from home, no one's telling you what to do. You haven't got a boss looking over your shoulder, you know. Obviously, you might have, you know, an editor emailing you saying, where the hell, you know, is this work?
Yes.
But you need to have self-discipline, and that's something I guess I've learned and taught myself over the years.
So I'm fascinated by the range of subjects that you're interested in, and one of them is faith. So you co-authored a book, For God's Sake, and it's on the role of religion, faith and politics in society. How has this notion of faith and the role that it plays informed your more recent works, if at all?
So that book, For God's Sake, was a collection of essays and conversations between four people, a Christian, Muslim, Jew and atheist. And everyone was socially fairly liberal meaning on a lot of key issues there was general agreement. There was disagreement on some, like the big issues, you know, the controversial ones, you know, birth control, abortion, those kind of issues that can be kind of hot button to some
yes.
people. But in terms of faith or no faith, that was very different. So obviously two of the four people in that group believed in God, pray regularly, have a belief in a higher being. And I see myself, as I said, although I was the Jew in that collection, and I see myself as an atheist Jew, I try to explain what that meant in a secular world, well, I guess you'd say in a secular Western world. Obviously, a lot of the world, in fact, is going in the opposite direction, is becoming more religious, especially in parts, I know, the Pacific and indeed in the Middle East and South America and Africa. So it's almost like the West is quite alone in going in the opposite direction, to the point where Pope Francis the head of the Catholic Church has not really said this openly, but has acknowledged in some ways that the Catholic Church in much of the West has lost a lot of respect for a lot of reasons, not least obviously child sex abuse allegations and all these other problems in the last 10, 15 years. So the Church is looking more for new pastures, so to speak, and that's often in countries that Pacific or Africa or South America or elsewhere. But for me, I wanted to explain in that book that it's possible to be proudly Jewish and secular and atheist and not necessarily, I guess I often question, some listeners will be aware of this so-called New Atheist movement that emerged after 9/11. Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, a number of quite prominent intellectuals, mostly in the US and the UK, saying that essentially religion is evil and religion is terrible. And Christopher Hitchens wrote a book called God Is Not Great, essentially arguing that the belief in God and a higher mystical being is at the root of a lot of the world's problems. I mean, I'm summarizing a quite a complex argument there. And that book was very popular. Yeah, it was a very popular book, and a lot of people were, you know, related to that, in the West at least. But I guess what I argue is push back against that, although I personally don't have religious faith, I don't believe in God, I often think that people who have faith can be on some issues maybe less open to what I would call sort of secular human rights values. Clearly, having said that, having done a lot of work around the world, a lot of issues, I've also seen the church playing, particularly the church, a vital, vital role in providing support, resistance to occupation, to oppression, helping the poor. So the role of religion, I think, is a complex one. I think people who are very, very atheist, who dismiss, as some people I know, the role the church plays, I think is really belittling the traditional, quite important role that some religious organisations have. But at the same time, let's not forget the fact that when it comes to, for example, the Catholic Church in much of the West, the serious cases of child sex abuse and priests covering that up is obviously abhorrent. And the church, I think, still has not come fully to terms with that. So it's a mixed picture.
It is a mixed picture. And speaking of mixed pictures, I wanted to speak to you about Prophets of Doom, which was released, including a photographic exhibition about vulture capitalism and privatization in different areas. Did this work that you had lead to disaster capitalism?
It did. So that was the work I was doing in relation to places like Afghanistan and Haiti and Papua New Guinea and Bougainville. And maybe listeners will be interested a little bit in the context of our region. So let me briefly explain that. So the Papua New Guinea, as people, of course, will know listening to this, has been nominally independent from Australia since the 1970s, mid-75, so 1975. But what I find in my work, both in that book, Disaster Capitalism, and the film Disaster Capitalism, is that in many ways Papua New Guinea is only independent in name. Australia gives Papua New Guinea $500 million a year, roughly, in aid. A lot of that money disappears into corruption. The Australian government is very aware that it's going to disappear into corruption. I would argue they don't really care. And what I find over speaking to various people, both on the ground there and many officials and other experts here in Australia, is that Australia, I think, gives its money to Papua New Guinea almost as an insurance policy. This idea of saying, you keep your problems over there, don't come over here. We don't want you to be a failed state on our doorstep, to have all people from Papua New Guinea sort of coming into Australia to, you know, claim refugee status. Of course, Australia does not want that. But at the same time, we're not going to really put the work and effort in to address the serious human rights issues that are occurring in PNG. So my focus was partly PNG as a whole, including some of the resource issues. A lot of Australian multinational companies, foreign resource companies, have really gone into PNG for at least 40, 50 years, and the only word to say is raped the natural world there. There's no other way to explain that. There has been profound environmental damage. Locals have barely got any benefit for that, and there was a recent report by Jubilee Australia, the NGO, looking at the PNG LNG plan and finding that the company is making a lot of money. They're happy, but locals in the area around this project are being shafted, and they're pretty upset about it, rightly so. So But my main focus was Bougainville. So obviously a province in Papua New Guinea, which in 2019 is having an independence vote. We hope it actually happens, I might add. It's likely to happen, but there are a lot of reasons why Papua New Guinea government may decide to not allow it to happen. So that's a work in progress. But there was an awful mine there that operated for 20 years. It was run by Rio Tinto, a British multinational, and caused huge, huge environmental damage. There was a civil war that was sparked, and it killed up to 20,000 people in the 70s and 80s out of a population of about 200,000. And that's a huge, huge number of people killed. It's one of the worst civil strikes in the Asia-Pacific region in the last 50 years per capita. I mean, that's a massive amount of people who have been lost. And you go to Bougainville now, as I have, people are still grieving their loss. They are grieving for what they have lost in terms of their family, but also environmentally. And when you go there, it's almost like it's stuck in time. You go to see areas of Bougainville, often things that were burnt down during the Civil War 20, 30 years ago have not been rebuilt, and these burnt out buildings are just still there. And what is concerning to me, and this is what I wrote about in that book and in the film, we examine this, is the role that A, the Papua New Guinea government had, but also the Australian government had in worsening that conflict. The Australian government backed and funded and armed the Papua New Guinea army to commit grievous human rights abuses during that civil strife. And there's never been any accountability for that. So Australia, if it was being far more honest, would almost both ask for forgiveness and realise that its role should be far more listening than directing what should happen in Papua New Guinea and Bougainville. But too often you have white Australians going up there telling Papua New Guineans what to do. And that, I think there is definitely a unhealthy colonial dynamic that still exists between Australia and PNG, even though PNG is supposed to be an independent country.
So is this the perspective of disaster capitalism? You have a screening coming up on June the 4th?
It is. Certainly in the Papua New Guinea Bougainville section, that's what this area examines, is what happened during that awful civil strife, what caused all those massive problems, and how we can move forward. The film also examines Afghanistan and Haiti and looks at the question of where aid money from governments is going. It doesn't argue that aid should stop. It simply says that too often aid money that's given by Western governments, including Australia, disappears into corruption, and that's not, as too often is the case, argued, that's the fault of locals who just are spending and don't know where it's going, or local officials. And of course, there's elements of corruption in PNG and elsewhere. That's true. But too often, I think aid money is spent with particular agendas in mind, namely to benefit Western business interests. And in Haiti and Afghanistan, the results are pretty disastrous. So the film examines that and speaks to locals and says, these locals should be listened to. Locals should be heard. And it's amazing how rarely those locals actually are heard.
So, Anthony, you cover such a wide range of issues. Just lastly, what is a single thing that fuels your inspiration to continue the work that you do?
If I had to say one word, Saini, I think I'd say injustice. I'd say that the role of journalism and journalists who are honest and truthful should be to give voice to those who haven't got one, or to amplify those voices, and also to challenge establishment power. To me, and I've discovered this over 15 years of being a journalist, that I would say the vast majority of journalists, not just in Australia but around the world, despite claiming wanting to do that, actually want to be close to power, meaning politicians, advisors to politicians, business interests, corporations, whatever. Because that's the kind of, they basically want to be, although they wouldn't acknowledge this, they want to be almost stenographers or amplifiers of those establishment positions. To me, the role of journalists should be to be critical of power and challenge it, whether it's to do with Israeli occupation of Palestine or corruption in Papua New Guinea or the awful military adventures in Afghanistan. Journalism should be challenging that. And to me, if you're not upsetting someone in power, you're not doing your job.
Fascinating, fascinating perspective. Anthony, thanks for joining me again on Pacific Mornings.
Thanks for having me, Saini.
That was Anthony Lowenstein, an independent journalist, author, and also filmmaker.
Pacific Mornings